Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And oh boy, are we going to have some insights today. Because on the phone with me is one of my all-time favorite guests and a repeat visitor to this program. And that is the one and only Tom Philpott. For those of you who don't know Tom has served for the last 5 years as he's a columnist, a food editor, and a senior food writer for Grist. He was. He's a co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Cruces, North Carolina. And before that, he worked as a financial journalist in Mexico City and in New York, which is a little bit strange, but we're going to forgive him for that. And now he writes for Mother Jones. And I read his column religiously. And I love and respect every single thing that he says because he's always so smart and he's always so on the money with his topic. So welcome back to the show, Tom. Thanks for joining me.
Always good to be here, Katie.
Oh, I appreciate that, Tom. So you have written extensively about the almond business in California. And most recently, you posted a piece about how rather than ratcheting down because of the long-term drought in California, in fact, they're doubling down and more trees are going in. So what's the story there? Like, how are they going to keep those trees alive when they eat no water?
Well, there's a lot of money in those almonds, and for that reason, it makes sense for these operations. Some of them are family operations, and some of them are run by big, huge companies, in some cases, hedge funds and insurance companies and things like that. But, water comes at a price, and the price is getting higher in California, but the price of almonds keeps going up. Basically, you're talking about, some of that is, people here in the United States are eating more of them, almond milk and almond butter and that whole craze. But the real driver is demand in Asia.
Really?
It's going through the roof. Yeah, places, China, India, also Europe. Europe has increasing appetite for almonds. And the Mediterranean region, Spain, Italy, has relatively small production. Uh-huh. California grows about 80% of the world's almonds.
Which is astonishing,
Yeah. And so when demand grows, it is a place that people look to.
What's interesting to me about that is, and I'm not sure whether it was you who wrote about this or whether it was another piece that I read about almonds, but the sort of the big business aspect of it and the fact that as you mentioned earlier, the hedge funds, really large financial players are moving into this market. And that, I think, is kind of one of the more interesting aspects of the growth of the industry overall. I mean, aside from the demand, but the demand is obviously telling hedge fund managers and other sort of major financial players on Wall Street that this is a really good investment, in spite of the fact that they are going to have to end up paying a lot more for, obviously, they're going to have to truck water in, right? I mean, how are they going to manage that?
Well, what they're doing now is tapping wells. They are dropping wells and tapping groundwater. And I think from the sort of time frame of these investors, they think maybe, 20, 30 years into the future for a land investment. What you're doing is you're buying land, which is expensive itself, and then a lot of, putting in an orchard, a let's say, a 1,000-acre orchard is no mean thing either. Lots of labor goes into that. Laying, you know, irrigation lines, dropping wells, all this costs a lot of money. And so they're looking, you know, not the usual, you know, next quarter kind of outlook, but they are, you know, maybe a couple decades into the future getting their investment back. And they're making a bet that there's enough groundwater, enough water in the aquifers underneath the Central Valley to justify that bet. And they've got the capital to keep deepening wells.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the water table drops. And that is where you start running into problems, because if I deepen my well and water a giant 1,000-acre or 2,000-acre or 3,000-acre almond or pistachio farm, you as my neighbor might not have the resources that I do to continue dropping your well low enough. And so you get, you know, it's just basically this common resource that people with money are able to sort of grab just by being able to drop deeper and deeper wells.
Well, that sort of leads me to my next question, because I think in California and probably in the rest of the country will soon follow, but there are very few regulations governing the use of that groundwater. Isn't that true? And so it does kind of fall to the guy with the most money, and surely that will change. I mean, I've been reading, like, even in vineyards, they're also dropping wells all over the place because they, too, are suffering from a lack of water. And so, you know, I wonder at the expense of what crops, for instance, this is going to – I mean, which crops are going to get basically tapped out because of this? And then – I mean, literally, and then what municipalities, how are they going to cope with having groundwater, you know, be depleted by these big agricultural concerns and not by the citizenry? That's the thing that really interests me.
Yeah. Well, California is the only state in the West, really, that has, you know, pretty minimal regulations on groundwater. It's important to say that last year, after decades of fighting off any kind of reform or change, the state of California did impose its first ever groundwater regulations.
Oh, really?
Now, the problem with it is there's a couple problems with it. One is that there are a couple of decades. They're calling for every watershed to get into sustainability, meaning, you know, essentially tapping water at a rate that is being recharged, which is a pretty low rate because water recharges at a pretty small rate.
Yeah.
And so it's asking them to move into sustainability within a couple of decades. And the problem is that, you know, if this drought continues, and we can talk about the likelihood of that in a second.
Yeah.
But if the drought continues, we may not have a couple of decades of groundwater in every part of the Central Valley. Now, it's got different aquifers in different parts, but particularly the western part and the southwestern part of the Central Valley, getting into the San Joaquin Valley, where a lot of this expansion of almonds and pistachios is happening, is in the worst groundwater situation.
Uh-huh.
And so the legislation may not be adequate, but everyone was surprised when it passed, because the farming interests have fought this stuff tooth and nail for decades. But things were getting so bad last year that I think people realized that something had to give, and so it passed.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of crops that are going to be sacrificed, well, the first thing is going to be stuff like cotton and wheat. These are relatively low value crops with not a big booming market for them. And so farmers are switching out of those things into almonds. But you're also seeing stuff like melons and other fruits in the Central Valley. Other non-tree fruits are going under the plow, and orchards are going up in their place.
Uh-huh.
And I think that, you know, the main, you know, in one sense, it's a rational move, because what the people will say is that when water gets more scarce, you want to move to the highest value crop possible. Right.
Right.
You want to get the most revenue per ounce of water. But the problem with these trees is that if you're growing an annual crop, like a, you know, if you're growing melons, then you can say, and I know a farmer in the Central Valley who's done this, you can say, well, water's really dear this year. There's a drought. I'm going to fallow some of my almonds. I'm sorry, some of my melons.
Right.
But with almonds, you're making a basically a 20 to 25 year investment.
Yeah.
You put an orchard in. It takes about 3 years for it to get up to start producing, and then it's got about 20 year run after that producing. And so, anytime you stop watering, you're essentially sacrificing that investment, and so that there's heavy pressure on you to water every year, year in and year out.
That's right.
That's where we get into pot. That's why this ongoing move into almonds and pistachios is doing what economists call hardening demand. Demand doesn't respond to raises in the price of water. It goes on no matter what, and so you get this relentless pressure on aquifers.
Wow. That's very frightening. I mean, I think it's just an astonishing, just an astonishing development. It's so counterintuitive to me that you would continue to plant, even at the high prices that they're getting, a crop that ultimately is, so water dependent and which you will lose your shirt on if you don't keep watering, and yet you're still going to keep planting those trees. I mean, just crazy.
Right.
But, when we're talking about sacrificing or fallowing certain fields, because there's not enough water, so if you don't want to grow, you wrote a very interesting piece about moving some of the key California crops to other parts of the U.S., and I wanted to have you chat a bit about that because I thought that was a really interesting hypothesis and also like an interesting look at California's potential future. So, I'm going to read a little quote that you wrote here. Is not only is California gripped in its worst drought in the at least 1,200 years, but climate models and the fossil record suggest that its 21st century precipitation levels could be significantly lower than the 20th century norm when California emerged as a fruit and vegetable behemoth. So, first of all, where did you get that number of 1,200 years? Like, is that...
Most of the most of the numbers in that sentence come from a study by this incredible researcher out of Berkeley named C. Lynn Ingram. She's a paleoclimatologist.
Right.
So she looks at stuff like tree rings and soil sediments to figure out what has gone on in California in the past. And what she has found, she wrote a book called The West Without Water, and she's also done some scholarly studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals. And what she's found is that if you go back and look at how the California climate has been in the past over the thousands and thousands of years, what she figured out is that the 20th century, when we built all this infrastructure to move water from the mountains and flood the Central Valley and make it bloom. What you found is that it was a very wet century. It was an unusually wet century. Just sort of randomly. And if it reverts to mean, so if it becomes just like another, like the average century, if we're reverting to mean right now, which there's a lot of evidence that, there's been less precipitation, even apart from this current drought, then she says we can expect about 15% less precipitation in California.
Yowza.
And this is without climate change.
And so
she's pretty sure that we're reverting to mean, that we're going back to a normal century. And then when you add climate change to it, what that does is that means that the mix of precipitation that we're getting is moving from less snow to more rain. And that's really bad news for California, because the way that the Central Valley works is that we've got these two massive projects, the State Project and the Central Valley Project, that move water from the Sierra Nevada mountains. The snow gathers in those mountains. You get the snowpack, and then it melts in the spring. And these projects move that snow melt to these farms, and the whole thing is built on that snow melt.
Yeah.
But you're talking about 85%, 15% less precipitation in general. And then when you move from snow to rain, it's less easy to capture. It runs off more easily. It's less useful to farmers. So those two things are telling us that, if she's right, that California can expect a lot less water, irrespective of this current drought. Even if we move out and get closer to normal snowpacks in the winter next year, we're still dealing with less overall resource. And, you know, a similar analysis, you know, we get something like two-thirds of our winter vegetables from the Imperial Valley, way down in the south of California, along the Mexican border.
Yeah.
And that's facing the Colorado River, and it's got a whole, its own, you know, horrible set of problems.
Yes.
that I'm writing about right now. So that, you know, that's winter vegetables, summer vegetables, are both grown in California and coming into crisis. And so what I say in my, what I've said in a couple of different pieces is that it makes sense that California would be this agricultural behemoth. It's got this Mediterranean climate. It's got this irrigation infrastructure that's pretty amazing. It's got these deep aquifers in the Central Valley that are being tapped, that, you know, way too fast, but they still exist. So it makes sense, you know, basically, you know, it's summer year round there. And so it makes sense that it would grow lots of food. But does it, can it really, can we really expect it to grow as much as it is now? And if you look at the list of commodities that are grown there, it's, you know, broccoli, spinach, lettuce, cauliflower, strawberries, all these things that we've really become sort of hooked on, you know, 75, 85, 95% of them come from California.
Yeah.
So my modest proposal is that, you know, I'm kind of looking now region by region and seeing that there's great potential to grow, not sort of take California off the map, off the food map, and disregard California, but just lessen the pressure on it by growing more food in the Midwest, where right now we're growing, you know, almost 100% corn and soybeans, which is neat.
Right.
We could be, you know, we could devote not all the acreage or a huge chunk of the acreage, but a small amount of acreage there devoted to fruits and vegetables could take a lot of pressure off California. I looked at cotton acres in the southeast, sort of the old King Cotton country.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's producing, it's highly subsidized. It's, you know, basically in the grip of herbicide resistance because it's all, you know, Roundup Ready cotton, and they're having, you know, the whole herbicide resistance weed problem started in the south. And it's raging there. It's still the worst place in the country for it.
Wow.
Why not break that cycle and take some of that land and put it into fruits and vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
I think the Northeast, up where you guys are, is also a great candidate for growing more. You know, and this is obviously, you know, the vision that I'm kind of pushing here would put us more into thinking seasonally and more regionally. I'm not saying everyone gets their fruits from 10 miles away. What I'm saying is let's not completely re-regionalize, but move in that direction. Spread out fruit and vegetable production from this area that is under such severe water pressure. And if you look at a precipitation map, you know, it's a very stark. I put it in a recent Mother Jones piece.
Yeah.
The left side of the map for California is you know, the precipitation in the American West is, and even in good years, the map I put up is from like 1961 to 1990.
Yeah.
So even in, you know, good sort of before climate change really took hold kinds of years, most of the precipitation that falls in the United States is in the eastern part of the country.
Yes.
And so my modest proposal is, because, you know, we did grow fruits and vegetables in all those places. For this, you know, we had this massive specialization in the late 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But let's rededicate some fruits and vegetables. Let's rededicate some farmland in those areas to fruits and vegetables.
Well, I think it makes all kinds of sense in terms of just re-regionalizing this food system to lower transport costs and to increase job opportunities, you know, around the country. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why that would be a fantastic way to you know, sort of deal with some of the climate issues and some of the water issues that are facing the California economy. But what would it do to the California economy, actually, if we started moving, you know, large quantities of vegetable growth to other parts of the nation, you know, in order to compensate for their lack of water? Like, I'm just thinking, like, if California is sort of going to become re-desertified, as it were, what do you speculate will happen to that economy? Like, how will they compensate for it? Will people just start leaving the southern part of the state, for example, like the Imperial Valley, as you described, which is probably really struggling for water at this point? And what impact actually, what I really want to know is what impact is that going to have on farm workers too?
Right. Well, let's take a macro view for a second.
Sure.
And the macro view is unexpected to me. If you look, so you think about California as this food production behemoth. It's, you know, by far the biggest actual food producer in the United States, taking aside the massive feed production that happens in the Midwest.
Right.
You know, it grows a huge portion of our food. You know, it's this export behemoth in terms of almonds, wine grapes.
Yeah.
All these things are exported. They bring all this money in. I think the number is the California food economy is something like $44 billion.
Wow.
A lot of money, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at the California GDP, it represents about 2%. The whole farming industry represents about 2%.
Really?
GDP. And what that's telling you is that things like high tech, you know, Silicon Valley, things like entertainment and Hollywood, these things have gotten so massive and so profitable that they've dwarfed the farming economy in terms of overall output.
Right.
And so when you think about it like that, it's a bit of a blip in California, even though it takes 80% of the water resource. But, you know, the other thing that I think it's important to say is that, you know, where I see it probably going is this. I don't see this almond expansion ending, and I see, you know, I see this massive continued move in the Central Valley into almonds. And I think, you know, Imperial Valley is where we get our winter vegetables. There's a place called the Salinas Valley. There's all these valleys in California.
Yeah.
The Salinas one is on the coast just south of San Francisco, and it's where we, it really is our salad basket, where we get most of our salad greens. It doesn't have great water situation either. It's, rapidly pumping its groundwater aquifers. It doesn't have any access to any surface water, so it's completely dependent on groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. So what I see is these places kind of slowly ramping down as the rest of the country. That's kind of my best case scenario.
Yeah.
Now, the farm worker question, you know, we're already seeing in the Central Valley that when they fallow crops, it tends to be the more labor intensive ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, basically almonds are labor intensive to plant them. Then after that, they're pretty capital intensive. They've got these big machines that come through. I've seen it happen. It's huge trucks come through and shake the trees.
Yeah.
And the almonds drop and they're captured, and one guy in a truck can do an incredible amount of work.
Wow.
So the labor intensive hand picked crops that tend to get fallowed. And so you're already seeing in California farm country lots of pain, lots of unemployment. People who are already low income are suffering. And I think that, you know, I think that is a trend that we can expect to continue.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that if this vision of the Californifying fruit and vegetable production comes true, then you're going to see demand for farm labor in places like the Midwest, places like the South.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a geographical shift in these things. And I think, you know, I think we can see that. I think it's a fair point to say that just as water has been this sort of invisible, we've come to expect all these, you know, this bounty of California fruits and vegetables as if water were free, as if it were this, you know, non-precious commodity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we've sort of externalized the cost of water in a lot of ways.
Very much so.
All this stuff is subsidized, basically. Like these giant irrigation projects were built with government cash. The fact that there's no effective regulation on groundwater pumping is a kind of subsidy, I think. So we've externalized these costs. And farm labor, the cheapness of farm labor, the way farm labor is treated, the low pay, the long hours, the danger, these are also externalized costs in our food system. And I think that, you know, what I hope is that this decalifornification process also includes an increase in the labor rate for farm workers and better working conditions, things like that.
Yeah, well, let's hold that thought, and we're going to take a quick sponsor break here, Tom, and then we'll be right back to talk more about farm labor and labor practices in general and how that ties into immigration reform and why we're not getting any of that. So stay tuned, folks, for more with Tom Philpott. We'll be right back after this sponsor drop. And more to come.
Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and we're getting big ones today from my friend and colleague, Tom Philpott, who's on the line with me on the other end. You're in Texas, right, Tom?
That's right.
Wow. Yeah. Must be hot down there. I bet you're having your own water problems.
We are, in fact.
Yeah. No kidding. I mean, certain towns in Texas are completely dry. Am I right?
Yeah, we have our own huge set of long-term water issues here, for sure.
Yeah, and you have a big cattle industry there, which is suffering mightily. So there you go.
That's correct.
So we were talking about farm workers, and you've written a couple of pieces about Mexican workers who live in Mexico who export to the U.S. But, you know, their situation there is at least as bad, if not worse, than what was so well publicized in that recent documentary, Food Chains. Or, you know, if you read Tomato Land by Barry Estabrook, the Immokalee farm workers, you know, essentially these immigrant farm workers, and even whether they work on farms picking vegetables or whether they work in slaughterhouses, they face a lot of the same issues. But for the farm workers, they also face a lot of chemicals. And I wondered if you could just take a second to talk a little bit about how, you know, the chemicals that are routinely used in agriculture have an impact on the people who are picking our fruits and vegetables, both abroad and in the United States.
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a really wonderful book that came out about 20 years ago, I think, called The Death of Ramon Gonzalez.
Uh-huh.
And it is about how this whole question of how these chemicals impact farm workers. And what the sort of thesis of the book is that the Rachel Carson campaign against pesticides, which was extremely important in the early 60s, it really drew attention to the persistent pesticide traces that cling to fruits and vegetables and got people worried about them and sort of got, you know, basically kind of galvanized the organic, one of the first big surges in the organic movement.
Oh, for sure.
Thinking about this question. And so what the industry did, and also the farm industry, you know, the agrochemical industry and the farm industry did, was that they switched to chemicals that are less persistent, that are less likely to cling to the stuff we eat, but are more impactful on the farm workers themselves. So it was sort of this shift in risk from consumers to farm workers. And so you've got, instead of pesticides that persist forever, you've got more powerful pesticides that hopefully, in most cases, dissipate a lot faster. And so that really put the burden on farm workers. And that's kind of where we are today with it, that that it's true that there are problems with pesticide traces on fruits and vegetables and non-organic produce. And there's very little study on, you know, sometimes I'll find like 5 or 6 different ones on an apple, and all of them under the EPA limit, but there's very little study on how they interact together and have maybe a synergistic or cocktail effect.
Mm-hmm.
And all that's bad, but compared to the burden placed on farm workers, it's pretty minimal. And I think that's, you know, that's another one of these externalities in the food system, is that there's this class of people who basically take the brunt, chemical brunt of this. And so you see things like, you know, in North Carolina, fruit and vegetable fields 10 or 15 years ago, I think it was less than 10 years ago, there were cases of birth defects, you know, high rates of birth defects from women on farms, working on farm workers, I should say, not farm owners, farm workers sort of down there in the trenches of the field. And it's a huge problem. It really has not been solved.
And it also isn't much written about, which is, you know, as I sort of delve into this, I do feel like this year, you know, I hear more about labor issues, and I feel like there's more public awareness of what is actually going on down at the farm, and that it's not all that great. And so I'm sort of encouraged to think that people are starting to focus not just on, you know, whether or not something is GMO, but really, you know, the people who are actually doing the work for us. And what is the impact on them of using all the chemicals? Because, of course, you know, fruits and vegetables are not GMO. They are not. They don't have the BT gene. You know, they don't.
Right.
You know, they do have to use chemicals. They do use fertilizers. They do use pesticides. And I think that sort of gets lost in the shuffle. You know, because there's been so much press around GMO, and so little press about, you know, the other chemicals that are routinely used and are probably infinitely more toxic. But I wanted to just ask you about, you know, when you were writing about these Mexican workers and essentially living in slave-like conditions, isn't there any, can't the USDA or U.S. importers or U.S. businesses somehow enforce certain standards? Not that we have great standards here. In fact, we don't.
Right.
But I'm just like, I find it curious that we, you know, that all of these things remain sort of status quo as they have literally since the Dust Bowl. I mean, nothing has really changed for agricultural workers. Am I right?
I mean, I think you are right. The case in this community, this area of Mexico that we're talking about here, it's Baja California,
mm-hmm.
where a huge amount of our winter fruits and vegetables come from. Essentially, the ones that don't come from the Imperial Valley come from pretty much due south of there in Baja California.
Uh-huh.
And last year, this incredible L.A. Times journalist named Morosi, Richard Morosi, did this just spectacular, huge, I think it was like 4 or 5 part package on the conditions of farm workers in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it really was, what he documented was just awful. It's stuff like people coming from, you know, deep in the south of Mexico, in Oaxaca, places like that, coming up to work as farm workers on these contracts, and just getting screwed in the contract. So what the owner will do is will say that, okay, we're not going to pay you until the very end of the contract, and you have to buy all of your food from the company store.
It's like script. And it's like coal miners in Virginia in the, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, and so it's a sort of indentured servitude that happens. And then the housing conditions are horrible, sanitation conditions are horrible, there's violence, there's beating. And so what happened was his article caused such a stink and was so powerful, and what he was documenting was these are the fruits and vegetables that end up in Walmart and other, you know, giant retailers in the United States. And so those retailers and the big farms down in Mexico were embarrassed. And they put together some kind of, I'm forgetting what the name of it is, but some kind of commission to, this is late last year, early this year, mm-hmm. some kind of commission to address these concerns. And, of course, the concerns continue despite the formation of a commission.
Yeah, I've never noticed that a commission does much.
Essentially a wildcat strike down in a community called San Quintin a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of a spectacular event where farm workers not only went on strike, but they blocked the road through which all the food comes up from Baja California, kind of in the northern part of Baja California. And Jay just raised a big stink. And they, you know, the way the unions work down there, they're really corrupt. So it was a wildcat that was apart from the union.
Uh-huh.
And they ended up going back to work, but the labor unrest down there continues. And I think it's a story that is worth following.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly will continue to follow it. And I'm sure you're going to be writing more about that as well. The thing that I want to, I guess we only have about 5-10 minutes left. So I want to go into speaking of farm workers, speaking of slaughterhouse workers, you know, meat processors, there's a lot of similarities. And, you know, the recent books that have come out, The Chain, The Meat Racket, Barry Esterbrook's great book, Pigtails, that we talked about last week here, they all describe labor issues that are really very similar in the sense that these undocumented workers are being exploited. They have no legal recourse. Unions don't really support them. Maybe they're afraid to join a union. You know, why is it that our government does not have any discretion over working conditions for, is it because they're undocumented? It's such a convoluted question. I mean, or such a convoluted issue. It's like, why do these immigration issues continue to languish in Congress when, you know, there are so many obvious exploitative stories about how these people are abused by either this meat processing industry or the farm industry, agricultural industry. What's the gridlock about?
It comes down to power and influence. I mean, I think in the meat industry, if you look at the history of it, there was actually by mid 20th century, after the jungle and after the unionization process that happened in the early part of the 20th century, meatpacking workers made a living wage.
Oh, yeah. It was a very good...
They're essentially part of the manufacturing miracle, the post-war manufacturing miracle.
Yeah.
It was a good middle-class job, you know, not too far off in terms of salary from the car industry.
Very lucrative. These guys were making good money, no doubt.
Yeah. Made this sort of, you know, vibrant middle class was part of that. And in the economic crisis of the 70s and 80s, the big companies were consolidating the industry. They simply did not want to pay those wages anymore. And so there was this massive union busting that went on. And Ted Genoway's book, The Chain, documents that. And so when the union busting succeeded, well, they needed non-union workers. And, you know, at the same time, there's this Mexican farm crisis that was happening simultaneously, and so you get this flood of workers coming up, fleeing their farm crisis, partly because of NAFTA, mm-hmm. also because of domestic policies, and, you know, you get this, you know, massive influx of non-union workers, and that's sort of what happened. And also that the jobs became less skilled. There was as automation and technology came into play, there were way fewer skilled sort of butcher jobs.
That is true.
On these lines.
Yeah, definitely.
Sort of operating machines. And so, you know, it went from a proper middle class job to a job that pays about $10 an hour. That is also very dangerous. And without unions, there's no checks on, you know, there's no one fighting back on safety issues. So, you know, it's obviously a very dangerous job. And that fits into the profit model of these companies because their profit model is producing lots and lots of meat as cheaply as possible. And to do that, you need to hold costs down at every level. And this is a cost they've very successfully held down. In terms of, you know, and so it's a kind of convenient situation for these companies because you get this without immigration reform, with, you know, the sort of right-wing nativist attack on, you know, let's build a border wall and militarize the border and all this kind of stuff, you get this disenfranchised, these millions of disenfranchised people who can't vote, who are actually paying taxes, sales tax, Social Security, it gets paid by them, even as an undocumented worker? They're paying huge amounts of taxes, mm-hmm. But they're completely disenfranchised, they're ununionized, no one's looking out for them, and right. So it makes them all the more easy to exploit, and that's kind of, in a nutshell, the story.
Yeah, and that is, it's very similar to what's happening for farm workers as well, right? I mean, isn't it essentially the same, it's just a different product, but it is essentially the same business model, which is
same
to
horse.
Round up, undocumented people who are trying to make it get ahead and send money home, undoubtedly, always, in fact. And then there's this gridlock in Congress where, we don't want to change the status quo. We just want to shut the borders, but not until we've, managed to meet our quota in the slaughterhouse. I mean, that's the thing that really makes me, shocked and sad that it's so, our Congress is so corrupt and so, so off the path of what we all think of as America. I mean, I hate to be like all sentimental about it, but you do think that the country is supposed to stand for some things,
Yeah.
And it's like, at every turn it's just eroded and eroded. I mean, between the Bush administration and the big business and how they exploit people and the complacency of our population. And, I just feel like crying when I think about it.
And it's kind of counterintuitive that you would criminalize and systematically abuse the very people that you count on to feed you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, because,
massive.
I mean, American workers don't want to go into a slaughterhouse now, not for $10 an hour when you can get hurt or repetitive injury, repetitive motion injuries. I'm sorry, I'm sticking over my words here, but I mean, reading those books, I mean, the Meat Racket and the Chain, I mean, to go back again and again to these guys, but I mean, it's like everybody should be reading this stuff to understand what exactly is going on. And Tom, I'm waiting for your book. When are you going to do one about farm workers?
I am trying to get one off the ground on a different topic. Yes.
But you're too busy writing a million columns about every single thing. I mean, everything I read. I'm just going to go off topic here because we only have a few more minutes. We can't actually solve the problems of the world. But, I mean, you had a fascinating piece about neonicotinoid pesticides, which you and I have talked about on this show before. But you did a little piece about how bees, as it turns out, absolutely love their nicotine.
That's what a study found.
That killed me.
It was an interesting study because there was this idea that maybe bees can sense some things are non-nutritive or toxic and avoid them.
Right, but no.
So there's this wonder, can they do that with neonics? And the answer was no. Like, it wasn't sparking that neuron in their brains. And so then the next question was, do they discriminate at all? And the result was, yes, they do. They're drawn to it.
Well, just as a human being is. I mean, isn't nicotine, it's a highly addictive substance.
And they found that it was triggering this response in the bee brain that is very similar to one in the human brain to nicotine. And so they actually are getting a little fix off of it, but it's causing them all kinds of problems.
Yeah, like colony collapse disorder.
That is a very, very disturbing result, considering, it's not just honeybees, but all these different pollinators are affected. And it's not just corn and soybeans, but it's in, these things are seed treatment, the seed treatment situation, all these different crops.
Yeah.
Including fruit and vegetable crops. It's a pretty bad situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything we've discussed has been such a buzzkill that I feel like just going out and blowing my brains out.
Well, let's go back to decalifornication.
Yeah.
So that is, we're going to do more fruits and vegetables in the Midwest, in the South, in the Northeast, maybe other places. And we're going to do that alongside this movement that's happened. Here's something hopeful. The Fight for 15.
Don't know about it. Tell me.
Fighting for higher wages for fast food workers.
Yes.
Stuff like this documentary you just mentioned that just won a James Beard Award.
Yeah.
Things like Barry Esterbrook's book, that's coming out that is fantastic. I've read it.
It hit the paper. It hit the bookstores today, by the way, folks. Pigtails is
correct.
Officially out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now available. It's a must-read book.
Yeah.
These things are raising consciousness. So if we can de-Californify the food supply while we push for better conditions for workers on all of these, you know, factory farms, on farm fields, then we can start to see a future that doesn't look quite so grim.
I love you for saying that, Tom. That was fabulous. So we'll wrap it up. People, if you want to know more about Tom Philpott, you can read his columns on Mother Jones. Do you have a website you want to talk about, Tom?
You can find me on Mother, you know, if you Google my name and Mother Jones, my little personal Mother Jones website comes up.
Okay, excellent. And I urge people to read everything that Tom writes, because he just is always right, finger on the pulse, literally and truly. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks to my sponsor. And remember, folks, we're still in our Kickstarter drive for $35,000. If you haven't already donated to our Kickstarter campaign, please go to our website, find the link, and pay up so that we can rebuild our website, so that you can find all of these fantastic interviews at the touch of a button rather than otherwise. And so thanks very much for listening. And we'll be back next week. We're going to talk about water again with the U.S. Geological Survey. Thank you, Tom, for that recommendation, by the way. And we'll learn more about what's happening and hopefully more reasons why we can de-Californify our food system. And thanks for that term. I love it. So long, folks. Have a great week. And thanks again, Tom, for joining me today. Thanks for listening, people.
Thanks, Katie.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.